Artists all the time, they just take the art from their most famous, rarest artworks from the past and just make new versions in the present and say that they were made in the past. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it doesn't sound good when you put it like that, right?
No, but didn't he say that he was dating it by the concept?
Yes.
And I'm kind of team 100 Hearst on this.
I'm Ben Davis, and this is The Art Angle, a podcast from ArtNet News where the art world meets the real world, bringing each week's biggest story down to earth. Well, it is the end of March when you are listening to this, so spring has sprung or is in the process of springing, and so we are going to spring on you, our monthly roundup of art news, where instead of talking about one story in depth, we talk about a couple of different items that have been in the news with some of our writers. So today we're going to be talking about controversy machine Damien Hirst, who has spit out a new controversy around his famous formaldehyde animals in tanks artworks. Then we're going to be talking about the International Center of Photography here in New York, which has two different shows that we've reviewed, and some of the questions around photography as art and what it means to be a photography museum now. And then we're going to talk about ArtNet itself. It is our birthday. It is 10 years of ArtNet news, so we are going to be singing the whole happy birthday song on mic. I think it's going to be great audio. No, we're going to be talking together a little bit about the history of ArtNet and some of the themes that have dominated coverage of art in the last 10 years. With me to do all this is Kate Brown, coming to me all the way from another continent. Kate, how are you?
I'm good. How are you guys? It's nice to see you guys in person in the studio.
And with me here in the studio, so close that I can touch him, is Bill Van Meter.
Hi there.
So before we talk about the news, what kind of art have you been seeing? Kate, you're in Berlin. What's going on in the art scene in Berlin?
Yeah, well, it's definitely not spring here yet, I'm sad to say, but it is getting warmer. I guess the most exciting thing that has happened is we have a full house now, so to speak, of new directors at every contemporary art institution here. The final two have come into place. So earlier this month, Jenny Schlenska, who was at Performance Space in New York for many years, has now stepped into her role as head of the Gropius Bau. So she just announced her program. And then we have Emma Enderby, who's coming into Cave Institute for Contemporary Art. So things are seem like they're about to get really exciting because there's also Klaus Biesenbach at the Neue National Gallery, new leadership at the Hamburger Bahnhof. There's just all kinds of new energies swirling in the scene, which is kind of cool.
I don't know enough about this, Kate. Have these been like big absences that people have been talking about, thinking about? Have things been in disarray?
It's kind of just a coincidence for the most part. Like, there was some splitting up of a few institutions, like the Neue Nationalgalerie and Hamburger Bahnhof were both being led by the same person, and then they got split off into two different roles, which I think was a good move. But other than that, it's kind of a coincidence. But it tracks with the overall change of vibe here. I mean, the city is rapidly gentrifying, becoming more of like a cultural landmark in an official capacity. So it makes sense, and it makes sense that
you
there's
mean
always
more of a fossil? Is that what you mean to say?
Just more of a, you know, lots of new money is flowing into the city, more tourism than ever before. So somehow it makes sense. I don't think it was planned this way, but here we are. So yeah, Jenny, who used to be at Performance Space, just announced her program, which includes taking over the Yoko Ono show from Tate that is open right now. So I think we'll be seeing a lot more of these kinds of blockbusters. She's doing a Keith Haring show in 2025.
Sounds like she's bringing a lot of New York with her to Berlin.
Totally. And Hilton Owls will be curating a show also in 2025, I think. And Rick Gregetier of Venezia is also doing a show. So yeah, lots of New York energy, actually. It's true. But were you guys frequenters of Performance Space?
No, not at once.
Yeah, I frequented it on occasion, and it's a fun place.
What's the vibe?
You know, it's just super creative and kind of wild, and they have a lot of weird queer things coming up and nudity and jumping around, and it's quite fun.
And that's interesting. That doesn't sound like the vibe she's bringing, at least we're not with his first program of shows, right, Kate?
Yeah, maybe not. But I also remember that at Performance Space, she gave the whole institution over to the artists in 2020. So she's sort of trying to shake up the model. It'll be interesting to see if that flows here. I want to ask you guys about the Whitney Biennial, which just opened. You've obviously both been to that already.
You've been, Bill.
Yeah, I've been to that and some things.
First thought?
I immediately kind of thought that they should have also called it Haters Gonna Hate, because people go into it with a disparaging attitude And I really found some magical things that quite moved me. And there wasn't a moment that I really thought, oh, this is an anodyne experience, as a lot of people are saying. And I think with a lot of art reviews and just reviews of everything is that it can be followed the leader, and that when the first bad review comes out, a lot of people keep echoing that.
Yeah, the consensus right now on the show is kind of meh.
And I get it, and it's not wrong. And I think like the intro text, there was a disconnect between that and then what the show was.
Yeah, yeah. That's what everyone's saying, that they didn't deliver on the premise.
But I'm glad they didn't, because I don't want to see a show about like AI and like all these terrible things. So there was some really good stuff in it. Also, I think like if it wasn't about AI, a lot of it was about like memory and like transmitting messages from centuries and stuff. Like that's what they should have made the prompt about.
Yeah, well, I have seen the show too. I got my third case of COVID the week of the press preview, so I haven't written about it yet. We're talking about it on the next episode. Me and Danielle Jackson are both reviewing it for the site, so I'll hold my thoughts till then. But it's definitely a talk of the town. Have you seen anything else, Bill?
It seems like there's kind of like this Paul Cadmus moment happening at DC Moore Gallery. There was this really wonderful nude show.
Incredible artist, by the way. Paul Cadmus, artist from, what are you going to say, the 40s?
Yeah, like 30s and earlier, and I think he died in the 90s, but yeah. It's just kind of a real revelatory nude show that just showed how ahead of his time he was. And then at Clamp Gallery, they had a show of Pajama, his trio with Jared French and Margaret French.
I have got to see that. I haven't seen that. And Pajama is one of my absolute art faves. You know, those photos on the beach, these kind of like dreamlike photos, or these like mixed and varying configurations of people, small black and white images. It's like one of my faves.
Yeah, so it's cool. It kind of portrays this kind of queer life that didn't exist, or just at these moments of holiday. It's like this utopia. And it's interesting because there's also a show by the current photographer, Ian Lewandowski, in the front of the gallery. So it's this real juxtaposition between this modern, queer, kind of more multicultural life that we exist than to what that is. So I think it's quite interesting to see both of these two sides of it. And there's also George Platlines, who's having a moment. And, you know, he's got a documentary coming out later this year. So
yeah, those are all part of, I think, the what you call the Kirstein Circle, the circle around Lincoln Kirstein in that time period. Maybe that's a vibe. Maybe that's a moment, something to look out for. Maybe that's our cue then to move into the more contemporary art world. A big story this week is around Damien Hirst. I have to admit, when I saw the headlines around this story about some new disputes around the dating on some of these artworks, my eyes glazed over. But then as I've read these stories for the purposes of this podcast, I'm kind of thinking, no, this is a pretty big and interesting story. Kate, why don't you introduce the story about Damien Hirst?
Yeah, I'm curious why your eyes glazed over. It's not because journalists tend to like sensationalize headlines or anything, I guess.
I think I've developed some viral antibodies, reaction to viral media for sure. Also, like, Damien Hirst is always, you know, mugging for the camera. He's always up to something. People are always mad at him for that matter. Like, he kind of is one of the stock villains of the art news landscape. So, you know, in some sense, I'm like, are we just beating up on this guy because we need someone to beat up on? But no, then you read the story and this is a really interesting little bit of news.
For sure. He makes himself an easy target, but definitely something strange is going on. It was The Guardian that broke the story. I think it was early last week. And it's a developing story. There's like been more development since the first story came out. But basically, whistleblowers noted that three Damien Hirst sculptures, these formaldehyde encased animals.
Like the most famous Damien Hirst. Like if you close your eyes and think of a Damien Hirst, you're going to think of a shark in a tank. And these are in that vein, which is important to the story.
It is important to the story. I mean, I think when you close your eyes and think of contemporary art, it's like it's the Koons bunny and then these like tank sharks. They're the most immediate images of like this generation of art. It turns out his art company, Science Limited, had dated these to the 1990s, even though it turns out that they were made in 2017. And this gets weirder by the fact that they were actually shown at Gagosian in Hong Kong in 2017 in an exhibition that framed the works, according to The Guardian, as being from the early to mid 1990s. And then it got a little bit worse after that when a fourth work that is on view in Las Vegas turns out to also have gone through this sort of strange retroactive dating process. So it's just a weird development. But what's even weirder about it is that what the response from the studio and his lawyers have been, which has been like, in my personal opinion, a bit gaslighting to say like, oh, artists like totally do this sometimes. Like they just date their works, like, you know, however they want. And I was like, wow, it's like weird. I'm pretty sure that they don't do that. Like,
yeah, artists all the time, they just take the art from their most famous, rarest artworks from the past and just make new versions in the present and say that they were made in the past. Like,
yeah,
that, I mean, it doesn't sound good when you put it like that, right?
No, but didn't he say that he was dating it by the concept?
Yes.
And I'm kind of team 100 Hearst on this because
really?
When you read about these pieces that the annals come apart and like the original ones, they're like all bleached and white and like chunks of the shark are coming off. And if you're going to have like a bisected shark or cow and you want to buy that for your house and, you know, it's going to be terrifying
as
anyway, you want to keep it freshened up.
You've got like that perfect, like, I don't know, shark skin couch or something that you need this like shark in a tank.
Yeah, I'm sure the original ones are unrecognizable now and it's just going to look like powder floating and it's just be repulsive.
Or you're an ultimate fighting billionaire and you want to redecorate a casino in Vegas and you want like this iconic artwork for the centerpiece of it, which is the case with one of these artworks that's found to be post-dated. And you want a big art attraction that's kind of badass, and you're a Damien Hirst collector, and he gives you this 1999 work. You buy for about $8 million, and then it turns out, what do you know, it was actually made in 2017. Bill, I agree with you. I think that's why I was skeptical of the story when I first heard it, that I was like, well, yeah, it is... our conceptual works of art, it's a little bit blurry, and like I said, people are always beating up on Damien Hirst, so... maybe it just seemed like a little bit of clickbait. And then B, yeah, there is this thing about, you can call this a flaw with this type of work, or you can call it a feature of its conceptualism, but these works disintegrate over the time. There's been all this reporting about how like these animals are supposed to be these like kind of perfect science exhibit thing, but they slowly decay, and and he needs to keep refreshing them.
Yeah, I think it's the realities of what this specific series is. I want to know how he's sourcing all these great white sharks.
There's for sure like an ethical story that could be done about that too. I do wonder that. But just to your point about the dating, I do get it. And that was also my first thought. It's like, I mean, there's tons of examples of works that were made that have been updated later. But there's a key difference. I feel like my impression is that most of the time that that happens, it'll be like the date in brackets and it'll say like 1991, for example, and then there'll be a hyphen or an M dash, and then it'll say like 2022. Like it'll show you that it's been updated. Even like Felix Gonzalez Torres candies are certainly not the exact same ones that were sitting there back in the day when you see them. It's a slippery slope, but there's something different about really from the ground up recreating this work as a sort of what strikes me as a derivative is somehow different.
Or most famously, Marcel Duchamp's fountain. The original fountain, the famous urinal as artwork, was destroyed. And if you go and see the Philadelphia Museum of Art, what you see is a recreation. But they will very clearly designate that in the label, say like recreation, and tell the story of this recreation. And actually why that particular recreation is important, because it has its whole history as well. But the thing that's interesting about this is they do seem to have pretended like these works were made in 1999 or in the 90s. Let me see if I can convince you, Bill, because I was going back and I was reading Naomi Ray's article about Damien Hirst's art market, where she was talking about how there is this big asymmetry in it. The desirable stuff is from that early rare period. And then after a certain point, he really flooded his market with stuff that was much less valuable. So this really does look like you're going back. There's a demand for the sharks, a demand for the pickled animals, and just kind of like pretending that there's this whole unknown store of them that you've opened up, just kind of based on, like, as far as we can tell, like his claim that he had the idea.
It's just hard for me to think about like art in the house, about the market, because I'll never be able to afford anything. And I would just rather have one of the more offensive flowers paintings in the house than a bisected cow. I hope that formaldehyde technology has advanced a bit, so maybe these new ones will. But I do think it's just the concept. So go team Hirst, you know.
So we got one vote for Hirst. Kate, do you have a dog or a shark in this fight? What's your vote?
I'm voting against. And actually, I was also wondering what the conversations are that are happening between Gagosian and the clients that maybe bought those works or other ones, you know, like these are the ones that went on View. We don't really know what sort of backroom deals might have happened. And also my version of that is like, have you ever gotten like product recalls from like Duane Reade or whatever, where you're like, yeah, we kind of need to like take that thing back. Something was like up with it. And I was just like wondering like how Gagosian might have like framed these, like making contact with clients after these Guardian articles came out.
But Kate, I don't understand why you're con, because you just gave the really good example of Felix Gonzalez Torres and like brand new candy being poured down in mountains and stuff. Is that just because they're clear about that? So you're really just against the written component and the M dashes.
She's super pro dash. I will tell you, as an editor, she's super pro dash.
I do like a dash, but it is also, I think that's the key. And now I'm kind of like, oh God, I'm saying this on like radio, but like, I do feel that I've seen those works and then they've been presented as being an updated version or something.
The Guardian gives a bunch of examples. I think the difference is that he's fudging it. And they talk about when they were shown at Gagosian in Hong Kong, which is the initial show that people say was full of these newly created old works. They talk about articles where they say, oh, these works seem to be showing their age. And they quote Damien Hirst saying, I prefer them now to when I made them. And they quote multiple instances where he seems to be fudging the fact that these are freshly created 2017 works. And I do think there's something weird about that. I do think that there are conceptual practices like Felix Gonzalez Torres where it's part of its idea. I'm actually totally fine with Damien Hirst perpetually renewing his shark tanks and animal tanks, but there is something weird about you're selling people something saying like, look, this is my rarest, most important kind of sculpture, and then it turns out it's not that. I mean, he could have just said it was 2017. I'm going back to the well of this idea that worked for me, but it's a new one. Obviously, he doesn't do that because there's a certain cachet to that period and there's a certain rarity associated with these works that if you can just redo it, it changes what you're selling people. So it just feels a little bit like a false.
Exactly. And that's the difference, I think, between like updating the candy, like updating a shark inside of a tank is a different thing than creating a new tank, right? Like that to me was the difference.
When I've encountered these works, I just like run right past them. You know, I don't need to see a bisected cow and shark. It just kind of seems that this moment in art has really passed. And I distinctly remember seeing them at the Brooklyn Museum for that like shocking show, you know, the one with the Chris O'Feely dung Mary and all this stuff. I'm just shocked that they're making these again and that there's a demand to see these. They seem so just of that era.
90s nostalgia, man. Well, I think maybe that's our cue then to go from something you don't like, which is Damien Hirst, to something you do like because you wrote this great review of this 80s artist, David Seidner, at the International Center of Photography here in New York. It's the ICP's 50th birthday, so they have this show and then another show, which is of their collection, which I reviewed. So I really wanted to talk to you about this feature you did and just about your impressions of the museum because it seems to be at a pivot moment in its history.
I do like Damien Hirst. It's just that the animal stuff kind of loses me. I kind of like the stuff everyone hates. I like the decorative stuff. So the ICP, I did a story recently about a photographer, David Seidner, who died in 1999 at the age of 42 from AIDS. He was a fashion and art photographer, and he kind of really didn't stay in a lane. It's hard enough to do now for an artist working in those milieu. And back then, it just really kind of didn't happen as much.
Did you know him before? He's not a figure I'd heard of.
I'd never heard of him. I read that he had a contract with Yves Saint Laurent when he was like a 22-year-old American and had moved to Paris. And he was like this huge photographer, had this massive career. And he just has not had a legacy ever since he died in 99. There has not been any stateside show. He hasn't been trending on Instagram or social media or anything. And his work was kind of anachronism. And so much of it is just lost into what was printed in magazines and has gone into the ether. And so I just really wanted to go into this to find out who this person was. The press stuff they sent out, it wasn't super compelling, the imagery, but I knew the narrative and the story was, whatever that was.
And I should say, this is what I would call a classic Bill Van Meter article in that you just go deep. You talk to a ton of people to reconstruct the social circles around this guy, kind of what made him interesting to people. I hope people read the article because it's one of these articles that took a lot of work. You really went deep into this guy's life.
How many people did you interview, Bill?
I think like 10 people. I went into it thinking like, I'm not going to do what I do and interview way too many people and make this some huge, large project that eats my life. And I'm just going to talk to the curator and do a Q&A and that's it. And then I can never stick to that. But it was worth it. I went into it just kind of like jumping into a hole because I had no clue who this person was or was completely unfamiliar with their work. And so the first interviews were kind of like, so tell me about your friend, you know? And then during this, there was really a lot of discovery. And
who are some of the people you spoke to for this story, Bill?
I talked to a lot of his close friends and confidants, like two of his best friends, like one who was with him at that last stage and kind of ushered him into his death, basically, and when he worked on his final series, but also his main muses, the model Violeta Sanchez and Adele Lutz. She was married to David Byrne forever, and she's a wonderful artist in her own right and did a lot of work with textile art. And she is Tina Chow's sister. Tina Chow was one of his real main muses, and she died of AIDS in 92. And also to An Dong, who is an artist now as well. And she is a Vietnamese-French ballet dancer at the time that he discovered in a nightclub and launched her modeling career in the 80s.
Were they involved in the show? My impression is that these are people you just talked to and it was...
No. I tracked everybody down. I'm a good tracker.
To emphasize, you add something to this story of David Seidner that's not in the show.
Some of their images were in the show.
Right, of them. But I mean, like, they're, you know, the stories that you uncovered are not... Are like
right. So media? Like kind of the story of him wasn't really being told. So I think it's, you know, kind of a good pairing.
It's so nice reading your article and then having this like exquisite image of An Duong, for example, and then hearing her behind the scenes recollections of like how that image was created. I mean, it really feels like this should be on didactic panels at the museum if it wasn't already, you know, and it's surprising that this research was not done internally. So, you know, praise to you.
That's also why writing it was so hard, but also so easy because every single person was so intelligent. It's like that book Savage Beauty or something where you just build voices upon voices and just everyone is smarter than the next, but everyone was just such a good talker and so open. When you're doing like a research article about someone who's passed away, it causes like a lot of emotions, a lot of this and that. And a lot of times people don't want to speak. For this, every single person that I contacted, you know, there's super successful people. They just dropped everything to immediately talk to a journalist and really put their trust with me. So it really reflects upon him as an artist in person, I think.
He seems like he had a real fairy tale come up.
Yeah, he did. And it was such a particular time to be working in the early 80s because it was such a transition in art and in fashion and to just kind of have this, you know, it seemed like what was a charmed life. But also at the same time, you have to think that he was diagnosed with HIV at a time. And this was at a time that there is no light at the end of the tunnel. It slammed shut. So throughout this whole period, he knew that there was an end to it. And so that's factored into a lot of the work. And you'll see so many things, and it's the most crazy, intricate image, and you'll be wondering where this came from, and it's from a front-of-book makeup story from a fashion magazine.
Yeah, the show's called Fragments, and that seems to have been his technique. He liked these kind of like, not deconstructed, but like, he liked to assemble an image. There's a lot of craft to his images.
He just kind of specialized in the beginning with doing segmenting and like kind of like stitching together different images, but he would refract people through mirrors and kind of really create this whole different world. And it was really disconnected from the time. It was very not of the 80s. It seemed connected to the 50s, but it also seemed futuristic, but it was very not hip. It was very couture. He wasn't like huge in America. He was an aberration at the time, and he continued to be so.
His work makes me think of Helmut Newton, who was obviously like much older than him, but then also it seems like Paul Sapuya, you know, the contemporary young photographer, could have drawn inspiration from him. Like, he does really seem like he was working either in the past or in the future in this really specific way. His work is beautiful. I also didn't know about it.
It's weird that so much work from that era is not celebrated now, frankly, because the graphic design was so terrible of magazines. It's really true. You know, like there's just so much that's just lost into the ether because of it.
And yet I feel like you read it and it's like a kind of career that maybe people don't have now, which is, I guess, kind of gets into the questions about photography now, because he was selected kind of in Paris to be what fashion designer?
Yves Saint Laurent.
Yves Saint Laurent. And kind of became a character in that world. And then magazines gave him the ability to have this kind of interesting life as an image maker, making these artworks that straddle art and fashion photography, really.
It also kind of made me think that it's such a modern story as of these days, how like a 22-year-old will start at the top. And so that happened in 1980 is something that I think really connects to today, because then there was like this huge space. But, you know, the talent really shone back then. And there's so much that there's just no room to put into the story. He also made sculpture, and like there's all kinds of like weird twists and turns that the story's much richer. I hope people delve into it more deeper, and that there's more shows, because everyone interviewed has their own personal work that he's made, and there's so much work out there that can be gathered.
Well, I think that for me, this show is kind of the best of what the ICP does or can do, which is like celebrate a photographic image maker who doesn't maybe have a space in a different kind of museum to get celebrated. And I just bookmarked that because, you know, I reviewed the ICP at 50 show. Sort of the theme of my review is it's from their collection, kind of tells the history of photography as something they collect. And it does feel like as that goes on, the history kind of gets confused as it gets towards the present. And in my piece, I talk about how it really seems like there was this autonomous world of photography as art sustained by fashion magazines and photojournalism that's kind of collapsed. So the story of that history they tell kind of ends with art photography in the sense of like photos that are being treated like sculpture, which is kind of interesting to me because I'm an art critic. I know more about that world. Kind of uninteresting to me because I'm like, I'm more interested in like mid-century photography when it has its own kind of like rules and systems and is really doing something a little different, has a different constellation cast of characters in it. I think the ICP is a museum on a little bit of crisis on various levels. You know, it's like a little bit like trying to find its mission in this world where there's so many images and they're so cheap and it's hard to get people to pay attention. And then art has kind of taken over some of the ways photography gets valued.
Yeah. I think also just that, you know, they opened up their 50th anniversary, this big blockbuster show, and then they have this show about this kind of forgotten photographer that it's hard to give attention to both of them, and that the Seidner show kind of fell by the wayside. There was barely any press about it.
I know. That's why I think people really should read your piece again, just to restate that. Yeah.
Yeah, I hope it travels. It was interesting. I didn't know too much about the ICP, I have to admit. It was interesting to learn that Robert Capa's brother actually founded this institution for quote-unquote concerned photography. It's an interesting mission. Can you also explain a bit about that?
Robert Capa, iconic war photographer, died in action, and his brother, who was also a photographer, created this institution as an archive for that kind of work. Now, the institution, in opening this show, very much emphasized, we've always done more than that. We've always done more than just celebrate photojournalism. Our third show was a holograms show, which is true, but it also it had this specific mission. And I think they've been very, very keen, for reasons that I find conceptually interesting, to emphasize that we do not just focus on photojournalism, which I think drives certain kinds of photographers crazy, because they're like, this is our place. You know, this, like, why did it have to be something else? But I think it does reflect, you know, a real, you know, crisis is maybe not exactly the word, but an insecurity about what it means to celebrate photography now. Here's a little bit of gossip for you. They brought in Cindy Sherman to be on their board a couple of years ago. She's prominently featured in this collection show. And in announcing it, it was a really big deal. They said she was going to help us with the 50th anniversary celebrations. And they talked about how, like, Cindy Sherman, being a photographic artist who works with staged photos, who does something very different than photojournalism, is one of the most important postmodern artists. She very explicitly said, I sense in reaching out to me that they were trying to say that photography could be different, could be more than what they have historically celebrated. As far as I can tell, no one reported on it, but I don't think she lasted very long on their board. I mean, I think months. I mean, I was looking at the Wayback Machine, the Internet Archive. Like, her name appears for just a couple of months on their board and then vanishes. I don't know what happened. People reported on her arriving. No one reported on her going. And she hasn't been a part of their 50th anniversary celebrations very much. There's something going on there. Since both of our articles, their director left, which is very odd for a director of a museum to leave during their 50th anniversary celebrations. People I know who have contact with the inside of it say, you know, it's an institution consumed by insecurities, which I think reflects, you know, the strange place that photography is at.
It kind of makes me think of like Fotografiska and how to have a photo institution, you kind of need these like real pop blockbustery things to survive, because it seems like they're kind of rolling in it.
It's a new museum or a chain of museums, for-profit museums, have certainly been like hogging the headlines, you know, with doing, like you said, really like splashy stuff.
Also having like a real sense of like, you come to the Fotografiska and then you can stay for dinner or like drinks and there's events.
Oh my God.
And stuff.
The ads for that institution here in New York were cracking me out, because the ads when they launched here were like, the museum, that's not a museum. Have you ever wanted to be a museum? That's not a museum. Have you ever wanted to not look at art, but be around art? It was so puzzling.
It's like, at Panera Bread, you can have broccoli soup and eat the bowl.
Well, look, it's ICP at 50. It's 50 years anniversary for them. There's another anniversary, which is the anniversary of ArtNet News, guys. This can be a short item, but I didn't want to let it pass that the website that we work for has just turned one decade old, which in the fast and furious world of the internet is a long time. Now, I am the elder here in the sense that I'm the only one who has been here for all 10 years. How long have you guys been here?
Oh, goodness. I guess six?
So, six? You're a six-year-old, Bill?
I've been here about a little over 2 years, I think.
You're the baby. You're the baby.
Yeah. The baby.
So, Ben, what's changed in the art media landscape?
You know what I think is interesting is that ArtNet News started in 2014, and I just realized when it started, its like mission was like, it's going to be a 24/7 art news wire. And I think at the time that I thought, this is like pretty kooky mission. Like, there is just not that much art news. We all know that this is like not like working for a magazine. It's like riding a bucking bronco, this website. Like, you're just constantly inundated, under siege with news. So it did work out. It's unimaginably huge compared to what I knew of art media 10 years ago. You know, completely exhausting, you know, never stops.
Do you think that the 24-hour news cycle that the art industry is very addicted to is also changing, though, now? Because it feels like it is a little bit.
I think we're at the end of a cycle. I mean, don't you think people are a little burned out? They want trusted stuff. Like I said earlier, you know, I've definitely got viral antibodies. Antibodies for viral news I didn't have 10 years ago. I was thinking about the history of it, and my first big hit at the site in 2014 was this article called Ways of Seeing Instagram. It was like a think piece about Instagram, which shows you what kind of time period it was. That it was 2014, Instagram was still a new enough phenomenon to be writing think pieces about. And it was kind of about how I was noticing that like the big genres of Instagram corresponded to the classical genres of painting, and my connections between art history and Instagram. The thing about this is that that story kind of went viral in the sense that it got picked up by all these news sites, because Entourage star Adrian Grenier posted a picture from it, a photo comparison between an old-timey nude portrait and a photo that Kim Kardashian had posted of herself, and it got picked up into this whole side news story that got covered by Us Weekly and all these other gossip magazines. It's like Entourage star blasts Kim Kardashian for how her Instagram is a tool of inequality or something like this, which is one reading of my article. And it's just such an odd thing. It was such an odd moment, but it really, I think, symbolized the kind of new way images were circulating and new ways news was circulating, new kinds of news that were happening then. And I do think these 10 years have been the social media age, and that it's partly because there's this continuous micro level story mongering on social media that the 24/7 news idea ends up working. And the center of gravity in art media has really changed from reviews to this kind of continuous commentary on the world around art.
Yeah. But I also think that there's also been some moments of encouragement, like the way that you can make news happen with reporting on news. You know, I don't just want to like disparage this 24-hour news cycle as something that's just like nasty and tiring. I think there's been lots of examples, even just in my time here, of seeing us like post reports, like the one about the toxic workplace culture at Mega Gallery Pace, which like led to a restructuring of their business for the better, I think.
Yeah, for sure. I was talking to Planet Money podcast for a story they're doing about art restitution, which has been one of the big news themes. And I was reading up, and one of the themes that came up is like, this is partly an issue now for lots of different reasons, but one of those reasons is that more people are writing about it. That it didn't used to be that there was an art media that was covering so much news about the controversies inside museums. The inside of the institution became much more permeable to the outside. And that's a good thing that's come out of the last 10 years.
Right up until Hearst sculptures, which might lead to more transparency in dating of artworks.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. More dashes for Kate. More dashes for Kate.
More dashes.
Well, I think we ought to close the bracket on this time period that we are in, that we've been talking about. Very nice to talk to both of you. Bill, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And Kate, always nice to talk to you.
Thanks, Ben.
That's it for this week's episode. If you like what you've heard, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts. Also, please take a moment to rate and review us. It would be a little birthday present to us. It will help other listeners discover what we're doing. The Art Angle is produced by Sonia Manalili and Caroline Goldstein. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.